Hey, I'm Jordan Rogers.
And I'm Luke Rogers.
And we're the hosts of Sports Related.
And we're brothers. We're going to bring the thunder. You're going to leave smarter. We're going to drop mind grenades. We're going to carpet bomb your brain with sports and culture. And if you're a guy, you're going to get in touch with your feminine side. If you're a girl, you're going to like sports. If you already like sports, you're going to know how to talk about sports. Even if you don't like sports, you're going to learn how to talk about sports. We're going to bring it, and we're going
to
bring it hard.
You're going to get to know us a little bit, too. The embarrassing background stories. Luke pooping his pants as a grown adult. Yep, it happened. I'll share it.
It's not a good story.
But join us, because we're going to give you something to take away every week. Remember to download new episodes every Friday at the Podcast One app or subscribe to Apple Podcasts or PodcastOne.com.
Racing, rides, people, and places. With your hosts, Brad Banjor, Matt DeAndrea, and Aaron Hagar. New media for a new type of motorsport enthusiast.
Hey, welcome. It's another edition to Shift and Steer, and I'm Brad Fanshaw, and I'm in the studio in Anaheim, California at the Bond Speed Media Studios. And you know who's on the line? Who's on the line? It's the mouse killer.
Yeah, the mouse killer.
It's double A-Rod.
Well, you know, you gotta get these little suckers, otherwise they eat your interior. And you know, like, I love critters, but man, I can't. Yeah. Every day I get two or three mice in these traps. This is Aaron Hagar here up in Tahoe, and currently I'm the. I'm the killer of mice.
Yes. You know, right before we went on the air, Aaron was telling me his mice and men story. And he said that it was pretty brutal. He said that he had a mouse, he caught it under his boot, and he said, "Listen to this, Brad," and he just crunched it. I was like, dude,
oh,
you can't
on.
Be like that. You know,
make my eyes tear up, man. No, as I was telling you earlier, I think it's a dinner for schmuck situation. I've got such an abundance of mice, I might start having to, you know, mount them and do all these dioramas. I played with taxidermy when I was a kid, and I studied in Lake Placid, New York, and I worked under taxidermist for like 3 years. So, you know, it's definitely
I had some problems with
knowledge.
The federal taxidermist once.
I don't know. I might be doing some mouse rugs. What do you think? Like a miniature bear rug with mice?
When you said you heard the trap go, I can't believe you didn't rush over there and try and revive it, you know, see if you could save the little guy. So.
Well, I was tempted, but it was kind of over his face, and I'm thinking, oh, brain crush.
That is kind of a problem in shops and garages where, you know, the mice, they're just doing their thing, but part of their thing is chewing on wires and upholstery and, you know, everything that we don't want them doing and, you know, crapping on our tools and stuff like that. So,
yeah, well, I'll tell you, I just picked up a Willys Jeep, a 1946 CJ2A.
Yeah, the one you sent me the photo of.
Yeah, and every time I drive it, I smell like this rat smell, you know, like feces smell and urine smell. And there's nothing in that vehicle. It's clean. It's painted. The upholstery is practically brand new. But I'm going, man, every time I drive it, I smell it. And then I got my buddy Dan's 29 Model A truck in here. And I just took all the upholstery out the other day and bleached the entire interior. Because every time I walked past it, I was like, ooh, man, that thing stinks. You know, it's a real problem, you know, with our classic cars. If anything sits and you don't have, you know, things to unfortunately gather up those critters, they can do catastrophic damage. And, you know, some of these interiors for these hot rod collectors, you know, that they get, you know, what is a Magus interior these days? 10, 20 grand, you know?
Oh, I mean, no. Ouch. I mean, you know, a good leather interior is 25 and up. I mean, some of them are
there you go. Well,
super.
Yes.
But you know, some of the.
It's not in my realm of expertise.
Some of the hints there is the gel packs. You know, they make the. You know how when you get something at the store and it has the little gel pack in it to keep moisture from the food or from the, you know, the part or whatever you buy. Well, they make gel packs that are the size of a small pillow, and you put them under the seats of the cars, and that musty smell, it helps with that because it absorbs all the moisture. And it's that must that combined with the animal smells make it even worse. It magnifies it.
Yeah.
But you can buy those.
It's a dehumidifier, right?
Yes. It just attracts all of the, you know, when I would store my cars, I would put one under each of the seats, you know, in the front, and it would just suck up all that moisture, and they work very well. They really do work good.
Good to know. Luckily, it's pretty dry up here in Tahoe, but I can imagine some of these collections where it's in a very humid environment, those would come in handy. You know, I had one of those in my mom's 53 Chevy pickup when it lived on the Monterey coast, and that thing would swell up in like a couple weeks. I'd have to go in there and change it out a couple times a month because it, you know, it was
yeah.
On the
well,
coast.
You're right on the coast there.
So,
yeah. Have you ever thought about getting a cat?
You know what? So many people have said that, and a couple people actually. I had some person actually bring me a cat and go, dude, you want my cat? I'm like,
seriously.
No,
and
there's too many chemicals laying around.
Okay, but there's another thing.
Like
there's another thing you can do is if you have a friend who's got a cat, just bring it over on the Saturday. And while your buddy's there, have the cat roam around and stuff like that. Because if the cat's scent is there, you know, my cat died, but I used to bring my cat to my office. You know, like every other month and let it roam around the warehouse. And I never once had any mice because they'll go, you know, it's kind of like a crook. That car's got a club on it. I'll go to that one. It doesn't have anything, you know. And they'll go, there's a cat here. I'm going somewhere else, you know. So that's another thing you might try.
It's a good idea. The other thing I worry about, though, is cat spraying. If I get a male cat or something like that, if it starts urinating in the cars, then we're back to that problem.
Well,
but I have lots of chipmunks here outside and a couple of rabbits. So, you know, that would have to be like an indoor shop cat, because if it got out and started eating that stuff, then I'd have to get rid of the cat.
Yeah.
Mice, I'm okay with getting
rid
of.
Well, yeah, but at your place, you'd want an indoor cat anyway, because the thing would get eaten by
a
bear.
Bobcat.
It'd be like a bear, you know. A bear would come up and it'd be out there cleaning the bones and, you know, going,
So, maybe I'll go down the street to the Nevada side and get a bobcat.
There you go.
So. No, I just have those electric traps. And you know, every day I just empty them out. You know, they're great. You know, they kill them quick, hopefully painlessly. It's pretty damn fast. And be done with it. Anyway, onward
for
mice. Brad, how you doing?
Enough about murdering mice. I'm doing okay.
Neither of us are at the concourse. And we're both bumming. I know you're bumming, too.
I've been going to the Monterey Car Week and the Pebble Beach for many, many years.
Yeah.
And this year I'm missing it. And, yeah, man, going into that little bit of, like, you know, oh, I wish it was there. Plus, as you said, Aaron, everybody, you know, gets a hold of us. Where are you? Are you here? You know, they're texting and like that. And I'm like,
dude,
no, I'm not. What do you mean you're not here? Is everything all right?
Matt's like, are you coming? I'm like, no, I'm not there. And today Merrick's like, are you here? And I'm like, no.
I know. It's I had people,
but it's nice, you know.
At McCall's Motor Works on Wednesday night, I had people texting me, hey dude, where are you? I know you're always here. And I'm like, well, not this time, you know. And so, hey, at least we're missed, you know. I mean,
exactly. And that's what I was gonna say. It's like people are sending me photos. Oh yeah, I see this car, I thought you would like it. I'm like, oh, thank you, you know.
So
getting pictures of Alfa Romeo.
People are sending me
Mini
plates
Coopers.
Of food and saying, hey, dude, usually you're here paying the bill. What's going on? You know, it's like,
I have a little, I have a little memory of somebody asking me if I was going to do a little mini meet. I guess there's a little Mini Cooper meet down in Pacific Grove or something.
Okay.
And so people
there's
have been sending
so
me
many
pictures.
Shows.
Oh, yeah. There's like a whole line of minis, and one of them's painted up like a police car.
I'm
like,
really?
Oh, that is too cool. Yeah, it's like, I assume you can only catch bicyclists. But
or other minis.
Or other minis, yeah. He's chasing a 1275 pumped up motor. I can almost get him.
You know what? It's funny you'd say police cars, because one of the things I was going to talk about today was collecting police cars. Have you ever known anybody that had a police car?
Yeah, I've known a couple people that have police cars, but not like a collection.
Well, like our friend Mike Russo, he's always been into police cars.
Right. Yeah.
He's had a couple of them.
We Yeah, well, what was that one at auction we took there a couple years ago?
I knew you were going to ask me that, and I can't remember what it was.
Sorry.
But yeah, the one that he sold at Russo and Steele.
Oh, yes. It was an AMC.
Oh, that's right, a Javelin.
Javelin.
Which
was totally weird
to see a Javelin Highway Patrol car.
That was cool, man.
Oh, it was very
cool. That thing was badass, yeah.
I mean, and you know, the California Highway Patrol has had a history of cool police cars. Like, you know, they had Camaros. I remember like 79 or something like that. They actually had Z28 Highway Patrol cars, Fox Body Mustang GTs.
Yep, and I remember those. The old Interceptors.
Yeah, and what got me thinking about it was on Hemmings Motor News, there was a Chevy Caprice, an 89 Chevy Caprice, the quintessential Highway Patrol car, you know, the square body.
Right, yeah.
And this thing was absolutely cherry, man. It had everything.
It had
all the stuff in the back. Didn't have a shotgun on it, but, you know. But
at 20,000 hard miles.
Yeah, but it had all the stuff, and it was totally restored. Had all the decals.
Wow.
Everything. And it was like $17,000. And I thought, that's so cool. But then I thought, why do I like them? I mean, you can't really drive them. You can't take it out and drive it anywhere because people be like, because I think it's illegal to drive a car that's got the markings on. I think you got to cover them whenever you drive it. Yeah. But I remember when the Camaro and the Fox Body Mustangs were being used by the Highway Patrol, they had to get special dispensation from the federal firearms because they had to saw off the shotguns to make them fit in the low roof lines.
Oh,
they saw like an inch off. And so alcohol, tobacco, and firearms had to give them approval to do that, which I always thought was kind of weird. And
well, I remember growing up, too, they had those IROCs.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah, like in the 90s, I think they had an IROCs because we were supposed to use one of those for my mom's truck, Ophelia. I remember I think Dad had found one or someone had found one. And that was going to be the donor vehicle when Covington did my mom's pickup originally. And I don't know what happened, but they ended up using a crate motor and some other stuff. But I think they had an old IROC cop car.
With a TPI motor in it, probably. One of those throttle
exactly.
body injections,
And my brown 66 Mustang had an interceptor motor, had a 302 interceptor motor in it out of a police car. So, yeah, those things were in abundance back in the day. But, you know, I think the reason why we like those, Brad, is because we don't have any bad experiences of being in them.
Could
maybe
be
shotgun, so to speak, you know. But you know, I went on a couple of ride-alongs with my old buddy Mike DiMarzo and in Malibu back in the day, and we were running around in his Caprice. It was fun stuff.
But,
He was on the blue line in Compton, so you can imagine a ride along in downtown Compton in the early 90s, man.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I mean, it is a big collector's market. There's a lot of guys that collect those, and there's a lot of ones with history.
Yeah.
Now, I do remember growing up in Scottsdale, Arizona, for a very short time, the Scottsdale Police Department had a Pantera. And
really?
Yeah, somebody donated it, and it was really cool. But it makes me think of, have you seen some of the police cars over? Have you ever looked online and looked at any of the police cars?
In Dubai?
In Dubai, yes.
Right? Yes, man.
They have Bentleys and Lamborghinis.
So many supercars, you got to be able to catch up to them. And I guess with the sandstorms or whatnot, they just get abandoned, right? Isn't there like big lots you see online filled with these supercars just covered in sand and dust and dirt?
Yeah. Well, the other thing that happens over there is people from other countries, expats. And I read a big article about what they do is they come over there with a job and they buy some, you know, crazy Lamborghini or a Bentley or whatever. And then they lose their job. And unlike here, if you can't pay your bills, you go to jail, you know, here, you know,
and
so I read this article about these people from London and from Paris and U.S., younger guys and gals that'll come over there, get the crazy apartment and get the, you know, because they're cranking, they're making dough. And then all of a sudden, they lose their job and they can't pay their bills. So they just like pack a bag and leave the country. And the car is just sitting there at the airport, man. And it showed this lot of all these, you know, like Bentleys and Ferraris and all this crazy stuff that they said they don't sell them because they're like, oh, well, you know, they just sit in the lot, you know, and it's like, what, you know, sell them. And, but it was pretty interesting. But yeah, those cop cars, it kind of made me think. And then you brought up the Mini that was painted like a cop car. And yeah, the Dubai cop cars have everybody topped, I think. It's
what a trip. Now, I wonder how the laws are about vintage cars. Like you see a lot of the old 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s, you know, Fords and such, right?
Yeah.
Running around, they have the single light on top.
The gumball machine on the top, yeah.
Yeah, like 40s or 50s. And even 60s, and those are pretty branded, and I've seen those not just in parades and car shows, but driving around from time to time. And I wonder if, like, you could use an out-of-state vehicle, you know, that's vintage, you know, pre-60s or 70s, you know.
I don't really know what the laws are on that. I know I have a friend who has a car museum, and one of the cars he has in there is the actual Ford Galaxy police car from Mayberry RF, or, you know, Andy Griffith's show. And
right. Well, that's like a movie tribute car. Right?
Right. But it still has the star on the side and it says Mayberry and it has the gumball machine on the top and everything. And, and I know he'll take that to parades, but I don't know that he drives it anywhere because I think he said he's not allowed to because the single red light is like only for police vehicles or something. So,
right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Cause I know like when you buy the old, BMW, you know, NHP bikes and stuff or CHP bikes that they, you know, they can't have any of the lights on them. Sometimes you see some of the electronics on them, but I guess you're right. Yeah, yeah, you can't run with them.
It's like,
curious.
It's like if you go to the Midwest, the volunteer fire department guys that have their own trucks and vehicles that when they get a call and there's a fire and all the volunteer firemen come in, they have flashing amber and white. They don't have red because they're not, you know, so.
Yeah. Well, you know, I found something interesting about my tow truck, which I didn't know, is one of my CHP buddies were here, and he says, hey, you know, you might want to cover that up if you go into Nevada, because you have to have an amber light permit for Nevada, even if it's sitting on the vehicle. And I thought, oh, gosh, so I took a spare tire cover and covered it, but I didn't look into that. So, yeah, there's all these crazy little weird laws about, you know, and lights and what colors you can run and, you know. Yeah, I don't know much about that because I haven't experienced too much of it, but I'd be curious to know some of these things.
I don't know, but collecting police, if anybody out there has a police car, you know, hit us up on one of our social medias, or you can always email us at shiftandsteer@gmail.com and send us a photo of it and we'll repost it. It'd be kind of cool.
Let's start a conversation.
Yes. And speaking of Monterey and everything that's going on up there this week, there was a big announcement that there's a car that's being shown for the first time up there that, oh, man, if Motorator was here, he'd be digging it so much. But there's a Mustang being debuted up there, and they're going to be built by some guys that call themselves the Venice Crew. And if you're into Shelby's, if you're into Mustangs and you're into vintage racing, you probably know who the Venice Crew was. And the original Venice Crew was Peter Brock, Jim Marietta, and Ted Sutton. And they are the original crew that worked with Carroll Shelby back in Venice when they built the very first 1965 GT350 Mustangs. So these guys got back together, Aaron, and they decided, I'm sure over some brewskis, that that they were going to get back into business building the cars. But Peter Brock, who was always, you know, he's the one who designed the Daytona Coupe and everything.
Yeah.
He has done some improvements. He said partially things that he always would have wanted to do back then and partially things that just technically weren't available to them. And, you know, one of the big things is that the car is going to have a race-inspired, fully independent rear suspension. And I guess in 1964, this rear suspension was developed at Ford but never used. And he's using that exact one. And so they're going to build a limited edition of 36 1965 Shelby GT350Rs. And now back in 65, when they built these cars originally, they built like 562 of them, but only 36 of them were R-code race cars. So they're doing 36 again. I can't imagine how much they're going to be because they're...
Yeah. Now, are these rebodies or are these... Do they find a lot of original bodies?
They're going out and finding original 65 Mustang fastbacks, and they're stripping them down, reconditioning the bodies, and then making them back into race cars. And what's cool is it is authorized by Ford Motor Company and Shelby America. So they're going to have...
It's going to be a continuation series?
Yes, they're going to have a serial number, a Shelby serial number and everything. So they're going to be worth
it. Oh, man.
Because the real ones are worth a bunch right now, you know. So,
yeah.
And so if you've ever wanted a real brand new GT350R and you weren't around and had bags of money in 1965, you better have bags of money today and get ready. Because
yeah, no doubt.
but they're going to build them in SoCal just like they originally did. And they're displaying it for the first time out at Monterey. They're going to start next couple of months, this fall of 2017.
Wow.
And they've already built the prototype, had it at the racetrack, and had the grandson of one of the original race drivers taking it around the track. And they said it's fast and cool. So that's pretty neat, man.
Oh, that's out of sight, man. Now, are they going nostalgic on the motor? Or are they building a fuel-injected motor are they
using original Shelby blocks and stuff, it said.
All original. Wow. Yeah. Boy, so that is really cool. How nostalgic, too. Mm-hmm. That's really cool. Because, I mean, you know, everybody could be saying, oh, we'll use a Roush motor or do this or do that. But, no, they're going back to the original blueprint with improvements. That's really cool. That's really cool.
Now, you know where they won't be racing those cars?
Where? Anywhere there's a noise ordinance?
No, the same place they won't be drag racing. They won't be holding the Moon Eyes Christmas show.
Uh-oh.
And where they won't be holding any more NASCAR races, which
Uh-oh,
is
we
at
got a track closing?
Irwindale Raceway. It's gone. That track has been kind of like on the chopping block for years. I remember talking when Pete and I did our other show, which was Rod and Custom Radio, and we were like, oh man, did you hear they're going to close it down? Then it got a reprieve. But ever since then, it has been on a year-to-year lease or a month-to-month lease, something like that, because the developer who bought it was getting ready to put a shopping center in there, and he was waiting on permits, waiting on all the environmental reports. Well, I guess he finally got everything, and it's closing down for sure this time. There's no more reprieves.
Bad.
So the last L.A. proper right in the middle of town racetrack is going away.
Oh, that's too bad. You know, I always hear little rumors about the struggles of racetracks, and I can only imagine just the financial overhead alone to maintain the track and insurances and liability stuff. You know, it's harder to get series in there. I know Laguna Seca's had some struggles. I talked to my friend over there, and you know, they're still running strong. Okay, don't get me wrong, but you know, the noise ordinances and all this stuff. It's like, don't move next to a racetrack if you can't handle the noise. It's like you dumbasses. You know, this is the thing that really bothers me about Laguna Seca. I just ran, you know, in that GT3 RS. A couple of weeks ago, and everybody's putting on diverter pipes, and they're trying to figure out, okay, do you put them low into the left, do you put them high into the left, you know, and it's like everybody has to short shift, you know, going through, you know, 5 and 6, and it's just like, really, for the sound ordinance, because people, well, I know there's a lot of reasons, and it goes into deep politics, but, you know, it's like, don't move next to a racetrack and then complain about the noise. I mean, what about the airport?
It's happened to every single man. And it's not even just, you know, like auto racing tracks. We used to face it when I ran the American Bicycle Association with BMX tracks. We'd have a BMX track that would be in the middle of nowhere. Then a developer would come in, put a housing development close by, and they'd be like, well, we don't want to hear on Saturday morning those loudspeakers. You know, the bikes made no noise, but it was the loudspeakers of the announcements and stuff. And it's just...
That stuff pisses me off.
I know. Yeah. I mean, look at... I mean, when you look back at L.A. and you think of OCIR and Riverside Raceway and Lions Drag. I mean, you just go on and on. There were so many racetracks. When I moved here, you know, a couple decades ago to Southern California, Riverside Raceway was still there. It was already closed, but it was still there. You could drive by, see the sign, and so was Ontario Motor Speedway, which Ontario Motor Speedway was huge. It was like a mini Indy 500 track, you know?
And I actually remember that one.
Yeah. And now they're all gone. They're both of them are shopping centers. So it's, you know, it's just, it's like down the street from Boyd's. When Boyd and I were partners, just around the corner and down the street from Hot Rods by Boyd, there was a racetrack. It was a 8-track slot car track. And it was a slot car track, but I hadn't seen one of those for years, and I was like, seriously? Yeah. I went in there one day, and it was like in a strip mall, and it was this giant slot car tracks. And, and just, do you remember the sound of those places? You ever go to one? It was always.
Oh, yeah, I remember the smell.
The burning. The yeah, the, but it was like the. Yeah, it was so cool. And they even had a like a slot drag strip in there and all kinds of cool stuff. But none of that stuff.
That's kind of coming back a little bit. I actually saw on Craigslist not too long ago, of all things, I saw a slot car set up for sale. Like
really?
For to do this exact thing. And I've been kind of seeing them around a little bit. I think they might be making a comeback. What do you think?
Maybe we should put in the world's largest slot car track in Southern California, Aaron. We could put it out in the desert, and it could be miles long. And you could – wait a minute. I've got it. Here's how you do it. The guy has a helmet on, a VR helmet. And then he flies with a drone, and that's how he controls the car. And so you could go miles, and he could know. And then we've got guys staged that, you know, if you flip off the track, he's got to run out and, you know, redo it.
There you go. There you go.
So.
Maybe we could do half-scale slot car racing. I've got the Top Rod company still. We used to build 33
roadsters. Oh, yeah, your Top Rods, yeah.
And, so, hey, maybe we can do take three people to put it back on the track, you know?
Exactly, yeah. You do them that size, though, then guys will go, I might as well drive it then, man. I want to, you know, make it a little, make it two-thirds scale, and I can just drive the thing.
Right. So. No. My partner and I retailered this interior because everybody was knocking them off. The original owner, I don't know if you remember those things, because we first came across the company when Tom owned it in Texas during the Texas Jam when Van Halen was together, and each of the band members bought one.
Okay.
And then, so my dad's was for my little brother who was too young at the time, and it just kind of laid around for a long time. I don't even know where, probably at his warehouse. And then eventually it made its way to the ranch, and my brother crashed it into a tree. And then I took it just to paint it, and I went crazy. It's actually a cool story. And I went crazy on this paint job. Took it to Laguna Seca because I didn't have anything new to paint when I was painting helmets back then. And people were going crazy over this thing. And I'm like, man, I got to find more of these. And then I had it in my shop at the time. I had this little hole-in-the-wall shop at a next to a bicycle store. And a guy drove by and said, hey, where'd you get the Top Rod? And I'm like, the what? And he goes, yeah, the guy moved the production right here over in Seaside. And so I went to the warehouse. I traded my 67 Mustang Fastback race car that I had. I traded that for the company, which I'm still kind of like on the fence about. But and so we restyled it to fit like a 6-foot person and retailered the body, added some more lines and swagger to it because people were knocking them off as a kit and copying them and making poor quality, you know, knockoffs for $500. And mine were like 10 grand. But we built one for Faith Hill and Tim McGraw, and back then Sony Signatures was ordering a few for me to give to some of their high end clients, and it was really fun. But there was a big issue with children because they were kind of marketing them to kids, And there's a big liability thing. We've got to carry this massive insurance policy, and it was just kind of a burden on the company. So we thought, well, let's market them to adults. And then I went through my divorce, and so we just kind of put the company aside. But I got to go to storage and pick up the molds. But those things were cool. They had 10 horsepower fuel-injected twin motors in them, and all stainless chassis and leather interior. And God, they were so cool.
Let's build one with an LS motor. Like those old Zinger cars, man.
Yeah. Well, I called it Ultimate Top Rod. And yeah, I still have the company. I'll put up some pictures. I had a picture of Dad and my little brother in the car when they first got it back in the day. I'll send that to you. We can
post those.
It's really fun. But I was trying to think of, like, should I make them into sidecars or, you know, like an amusement park car or, you know, because I have this beautiful body and no one's reproduced it since. You know, I've seen all kinds of half-scale cars out there, you know, everything from Ferraris, you know, I've seen a bunch of, you know, Mustangs and Cobras and,
sure,
and great cars, but I haven't seen this one. I've seen a 32, but it's pretty basic. This one's really, it's got some real nice compound, you know, corners in it and some really nice designs. And my friend, the late Sergio Vega, helped me do all the design work on the chassis, and he was really integral in that. So
that's a
every
name,
time I
man.
See it,
Sergio
I think of him
Vega.
Too. Sergio Vega. Yeah, he was just a jolly guy. Maybe we'll post a picture of him, too, as a little tribute. But,
that kind of stuff's really fun, always fun. Guys can always – why is it – you know, I will talk to guys, and they'll go, you know, yeah, well, I really can't afford a set of billet wheels, man. You know, you got pricey wheels. And I mean, I'd love to have a set. I would love to have a set, but man, there's just no way I could afford that. Then you go over to their house, and they've got a racing bar stool, and they've got, you know, three of these trick wagons they take to the, you know, with billet wheels and dropped axles that they take to the swap meet. And then they got a top rod hanging on the wall. I go, you know, dude, if you didn't have all that crap, you could afford like several sets of billet wheels. Oh, man, but I got to have that stuff,
right?
You know? What's that?
You have financing available, Brad.
I know. We do layaway. We do everything. So
yeah, so layaway. That's right. Yeah, layaway.
Layaway.
I see that ad. I get that email, and I'm like, really, Brad?
9 months? 9 months I carry these people. So
wow.
I,
well, you're a very generous man.
It's,
very patient, very generous.
Yes. And it works out great, though, because you know what? Guys are building cars and trucks, and they can't. You know, they want to order the wheels during a sale or something, but they're not ready, so we do it for them, and it works out great for them, and we like to give them another way to finance their wheels, because wheels are expensive, and especially if you get good ones made in the USA, like Bond Speed Wheels at bondspeedwheels.com. How's that?
So, hey. Well, the process, you were telling me about the process, and man, I could only imagine that would be a really hard business to own and run. Your expertise in field, I really admire, Brad, because there's so many variables in ordering a custom wheel, you know, that the backspacing, the offset, you know, that the lip, I mean, you know, just to name a couple of things, but I mean, there's so many things to know about that. Every time we have a conversation, my eyes roll back in my head because I hate math.
Well, you know what? It's one of those things where, a lot of the wheel companies will just say, dude, figure it out and call us back. And we offer that service. We will help people. We'll tell them what measurements to take. And we will do our best to nail it. And we're really good at fitments. But, you know, it's very intimidating to people. Even some of the top builders will call me and go, dude, I have no idea. What is, you know, how do I do it? You know, I'm like, you know. And, you know, you talk them through it. But it's good.
Yeah.
And
I could imagine, because sometimes when you're measuring stuff, on which side of the line are you, on the inside or on the outside edge, or the, you know, it's a little, I
can imagine. It makes your brain hurt sometimes.
And then you got brakes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you got brake clearances and fender clearances.
Well, I'll give you some of the things, like, you know, I've had guys that tell me their car is completely stock. I had a guy call me once ago. I got a 66 Chevelle. It's bone stock. It's just lowered 2 inches, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, okay. There you go.
And I go, dude, I said, Chevelles, speak no further. I'm the best fitment guy on Chevelles in the world because I've got a 66, a 67, a 71. You know, I go, I know these cars. And the guy gets me and goes, hey, my tires rub. And I'm like, there's no way your tires rub. Yeah, my tires rub. And I'm like going, there's no way. So I start going through everything with him. And I get down, I go, have you ever changed the rear end in this car? Nope, it's all stock. And I go, there's no way that this car would have the tires rubbing. And so we go back and forth. The guy's getting all hot. And he finally goes, well, the rear end was changed at one point in the car. But but it's not an aftermarket rear end or anything. It's a stock GM rear end. And I go, so you got it?
Yeah, but.
I said, so you got it from another Chevelle and you put it? Well, I got it from my friend's GTO. But it's exactly the same. It's a Chevy 12-bolt, drum brakes, blah, blah, blah. And I have this cross-reference book that I keep on my shelf. And I go get it and I look and I go, well, let me tell you, a 69 GTO's rear end was a quarter inch wider on each side than a 66 Chevelle. It's identical in every other way. Everything else bolts up, but it was because they bulged the fenders farther on 69, you know, GTOs. And the guy goes, oh, well, I didn't know that. And I go, that's why, because you've pushed everything out a quarter of an inch. Well, that makes that big a difference. I go, yes, that makes that big a difference.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Makes the difference between your tires rubbing and not.
They don't, and, you know, we've had all kinds of. Then I get the guys who built their own chassis. The best one of the guys built their own chassis. And they'll go, okay, I got all my fitments and everything. Okay, great. And he goes, okay, on the rear, we're going to run an 1810 with a 4-inch backspace on the driver's side. And on the passenger side, four and 3/8. And I go, what? I go, what?
And what are you, circle tracking?
I go, dude. I go, wait a minute. I could have sworn you said 4 3/8 on one side and 4 on the other. And he goes, I did. And he goes, I didn't quite get the rear end centered. And I go, well, maybe you should center the rear end and then we'll do the wheels rather than offset the wheels differently. Nah, I don't want to, you know. And I've had that happen over the years probably 4 times. And I'm just like going, oh, my goodness, you know.
Brad, that's why I don't make my own frame.
Yeah. I had one guy call, and it wasn't that long ago.
I could imagine.
Every single wheel was a different backspace. And I was like, seriously? I envisioned this car going down the road dog-legging, you know, just kind of sideways.
I know. I've seen those trucks. You see those lifted trucks, lowrider trucks. And they're, like, going down the road diagonal. I saw one that this lady was driving, and the truck was cherry. I mean, it was nice. It was like a C10, you know, all done up. And it literally was going down the road diagonally enough that you could see it at any angle. You'd be like, what the hell? That truck's going down the road diagonal.
I was driving down the freeway, the 405, coming back from L.A., and there was, like, I think it was a Ford Ranger, and it... I'm looking at it. I'm following it. You know, I'm coming up on it. I'm like about 5 cars back, and I'm looking. I go, what the heck is going on here? And as I got closer, this thing had been center punched so hard, and the guy was driving it. It didn't have any glass in the back, any glass in the passenger side, and the guy's cruising down the freeway. And, I mean, you're looking at the side of the bed. It's practically in the next lane over. And the guy's driving. It was literally going down the road sideways at 80 miles an hour. And I tried.
Drift car.
I did get out my camera while I was driving on the freeway, yes, and try and take a picture of it. I took several pictures of it. It just didn't translate in the photo. But I was just like going, seriously, dude, you're driving not only down the freeway, but 80 miles an hour down the freeway. And it was the weirdest thing ever, you know. But you see people. It's crazy what people will do.
But I mean, come on. If you're building a frame at home or you're building a rat rod or something, you know, I would love to say my concrete floor is perfectly flat for something that large. I don't have a jig table that big. But, you know, I could imagine that something could get off. Or, you know, you aren't a master welder and you start working on one side and you finish one side and, you know, it twists up a bit. No thanks. You know,
anything you've got to have
instilled. Oh yeah, you got to have a frame jig or something.
You've got to have a jig table. You've got to have a plate or something, because it can happen in anything. I had it happen once with a trade show booth. Yeah. We built a trade show booth in my warehouse, and you know, with a car, I think of it. Oh yeah, you know, it comes to mind. The trade show booth we built, welded up. Square walls, and then we put this stuff called Phylon. Now, Phylon It's kind of like around here at Bond Speed, we'll say, oh, yeah, that was a Phylon affair, you know, because it was notorious around here because built this extravagant trade show booth to take to Switzerland for the watch show. And I wanted it to look
bitchin'.
So I had this frame that was all, you know, brushed metal. And then I bought this Phylon. And what Phylon is, it was used in the 50s and 60s. You've seen it places, and they still use it once in a while. But it's this thin, brittle plastic that you see, like, fiberglass webbing through. You know, it's...
Yeah. You see it on roofs and stuff. Like
yeah, you can't see through it. Okay, well, yes, and you're thinking of corrugated Phylon, okay, where it's wavy.
Right. But
this is
that,
perfectly flat. Yeah. So we made these frames and then slid it down in between the frames. So you had these polished metal frames with this kind of caramel-colored Phylon, and that was our back wall. And
it was
bitchin' looking till we got to Europe and went to set it up, and... Their floor at the trade show. I blame their floor at the trade show for being uneven, but we know those are probably laser, especially in Switzerland, nothing's wrong, you know?
And right.
Theirs was so perfect that we started putting it up and nothing lined up, and we had started getting shims, and it was a nightmare because the Phylon is rigid, and there was no way. It took us... I think like 2 days to make it work. And it was was like my lesson of, hey, you do it with cars. If you do anything else. So every trade show booth we ever built after that had adjustable feet on the bottom, you know, because it was like,
wow.
But it was
It's like with anything, there's so many variables. And whether you're building a house or building a car or anything, if something is off, if something's not perfect and square, it just sets off a chain reaction.
The next
thing you know, you're going through a box of washers to get a fender to work. You know, it's kind of frustrating, and especially when we deal with all these old cars. You know, I think I spent 2 days getting a head bolt out. I mean, it's like, you know, you never know. And I get asked all the time, hey, you know, will you build me this? Will you build me that? It's like, you know what? I don't build cars for people. I maintain my own collection. I noodle with stuff that I like to do. I kind of get cars up to, you know, 98%, you know. But I would never want to build a vehicle for someone, especially from scratch. It's like the liability alone is so intimidating because so many things can go wrong. And it's just me. So I really commend the guys out there building cars from scratch, like the Mole family. I mean, those guys build every fender, every hood, every roof. They build everything from scratch, and it just blows my mind at the type of engineering and perfection that they have to have, the patience and skills they have to have, and their crew, to be able to put together and build a car from scratch. There's just so many variables, you know?
Well, it's like when you stand back after you finished a car, even just a muscle car or something, and you stand back and you look at it and you go, ugh. And then you got to start figuring out, why is it a little crooked? Is one of the shocks sitting lower? Is one of the shock mounts?
Yeah.
Or is the bumper crooked? Do we not get that bumper? You know, and you got to start figuring, you know, because it's just one thing after another, you know?
But, well, I got to tell you, that's why I loved to stand around with Pete and like Bobby Alloway. Because, you know, those guys would look at a stance and then they would get under the hood and under the body without even looking at it. Just knowing from their own experience as builders, everything that someone made a mistake. And it's not that they enjoyed ripping a car apart. It's just, it's so important to do it right. And those guys were the masters. They were the experts.
Oh, you're right.
I mean, that stuff.
When we were in Reno with them that year, when they were judging. I remember just what you were saying. We were standing there. Some guy had a muscle car, and it was a high-end, super nice muscle car.
Yep.
And we're standing there, and Pete goes, what do you think, Brad? And I go, it's beautiful, but there's something wrong. There's something off, and we couldn't put our fingers on it. And all of a sudden, Bobby goes, gentlemen, I don't think his hood scoop is centered. And all of a sudden, we all pinned in on it, and he had this little...
It was a Barracuda, wasn't it?
I don't even remember, but he had a little bitty hood scoop. And we walked up closer, and when you looked super... It was only off, like, eighth or whatever, but... It threw everything off, and you just went, oh, man, that was it. And, you know, for us standing 100 feet back from the car and Bobby to see that, you know, Pete and I looked at each other. Oh, wow. And, you know.
Those guys had educated eyes like I've never experienced in any industry. You know, they
so
were
so judgmental. They're just so judgmental. But speaking of crazy-ass cars, that Porsche that Motorator and I bought for Adam Carolla last year for $1 million.
Like eight people have sent me photos of that going, dude, there's this killer Porsche here. I'm like, yeah, it's my buddy's.
Yeah. Well, you know, spend his $5.2 million last year, and now I'm not even up there to see it go around the track, which really bums me out because they've been sending photos.
All over social media, man.
Have you seen any of the videos of it?
No, I just
go to Motorator on Instagram and watch the video because that thing sounds like a damn muscle car. It does not sound like a Porsche. You know, it is wicked. So, hey, we got to start wrapping up this episode. Yeah.
What? What do you mean wrap up? We don't need
45 minutes, man. These guys can't take any more of us. So.
There's so much going on, folks. There's always something to talk about with us,
We don't have to wrap it up yet.
It's not bad, just the two of us.
I'm swinging it around. No, we have fun, but I'm swinging it around to something that's near and dear to your heart.
Uh oh.
So
squirrels.
Mouse trap. No, and the Simeone, and I might be saying this wrong because I've never heard it pronounced, but the Simeone Auto Museum in Philadelphia is doing a limited run exhibit because this is a big, well-known car museum. But from August 19th, which is this weekend, so by the time this show comes out, it'll be started last weekend, through September 9th. So if you're on the East Coast, you better hustle over there because they are doing a limited edition exhibit of 30 motorcycles that really kind of represent, you know, the classic era of motorcycles. And I knew you're into bikes.
Wow.
And
totally, yeah.
They broke them down into three segments. They have turn-of-the-century bikes from 1888 to 1917. Then they're doing what they call interwar era, which is 1918 through 1940. And then post-war imports, 46 through the 80s. And some of the bikes they were showing were just incredible, you know. And it's supposed to be just one of the best motorcycle exhibits that's ever been put together at a major museum. So if you're into that stuff, might be worth
really
going
cool.
over.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's so nice that museums and such are appreciating automotive because we always argue that automotive and motorcycles, mechanics, you know, even engineering and some of these old industrial machines, it's art now. I mean, if you look at the way things were designed and the ingenuity for its time, some of these industrial, you know, vehicles and products out there, not products, but machinery, are absolutely stunning, and they're worth being put in a museum.
Yeah.
I mean, they're gorgeous. In fact, the Czech Republic, my wife's from Ostrava, and in Ostrava, they have this huge industrial building, and it looks like a water park. I mean, it's these huge tubes that just run across the property from building to building, and it's black, and it's just like the craziest thing you've ever seen. But my wife said that they're making it a museum, an industrial museum for the Czech Republic, and I thought, well, right on, because not only is the building like a piece of art, I can only imagine, you know, all the industrial stuff that's going inside of it. And her grandfather was actually, they had these books, I think they're annual, but they had these books on like the most influential people in industry and art and all these things. And her grandfather was in it for many years. He held many industrial patents. And so he helped me appreciate, he passed away a couple of years ago, but he helped me appreciate some of their industrial stuff. And then there's the Tatra Museum in past Brno. But it's a beautiful museum of all the old industrial vehicles. And they even had this wild-looking, it looked like an old panel truck, like from the probably the 30s or 40s. but it had a skis on the front and this giant fan on the back.
And, sounds cool.
And you could imagine. You can imagine flying across Europe in that thing.
You know what? They were going to start a big museum like that here in the United States. But when they started collecting everything up, they found out that when we tore down our factories, we just shipped it all to China and melted it.
There you go.
So it's like...
But that's really cool.
I was watching a show along that lines. I was watching a show, and I cannot tell you what the name of it was. It was something I'd never heard of before. And... I was getting ready to go somewhere on Saturday, and the show flipped on the TV, and it was Strange Places or something like that. And they said under Grand Central Station. Now we're talking. We're not talking just like a basement. We're talking 200 feet down into the ground, into the bedrock.
Yeah,
they built
a city.
They built. And this is back in the 1800s. They went down and built a cement encased room that is bigger than Grand Central Station. And and they said nobody until recent years even knew it existed. Most people didn't know it existed. And what it is, and they said, for the first time, we're showing these. And they said, still today, it's still confidential, so they won't even show where the entrance is to get to the elevators to go down. And because what it was back in the day, it's like, I think there were 6 turbines. And it reminded me of Hoover Dam when you look inside Hoover Dam and all those big turbines. But generated all of the electricity for every single railroad track on the East Coast. And it was operational up until, I think they said, like 84 or 88 or something. It wasn't that long ago. Now the turbines that are still going, or the turbines are not going, and they've put in all this electronic stuff that runs, the electricity just for the train station. They never did say where the power comes from for all the railroad tracks now. But they said it was so confidential because if anybody ever blew it up or did anything to it, that it would wipe out the whole East Coast and our economy and everything. And they said that they did catch some German spies during World War II, dropped off by enemy submarines off Manhattan, that was their job, was to go down there and destroy these. And they said, and you know what the funny thing was? They didn't have to have dynamite. They didn't have to have, they said all they had were a couple bags of sand because those turbines, throw a handful of sand in and it would ruin the turbine motor because they were open sides.
Oh, jeez.
But you talk about beautiful machinery and, it's like, have you ever been to Hoover Dam?
Yeah.
And gone inside it and gone down.
Yeah.
I did it when I was a little kid.
Down inside of it, yeah.
Yeah, I went down in it when I was a little kid back in the 60s, and I would love to do it again because it's just beautiful, all the Art Deco architecture and everything like that.
Oh, yeah.
But that's cool stuff. And, a lot of what we have now is not we have great design and everything like that, but it's also some of that old architecture and styling and things like that is pretty incredible, and you see it on those motorcycles like we were talking
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely, and you know the Peters Museum has a really nice motorcycle display.
They
and
do.
It's permanent, right?
Yes, that is a permanent display.
And you can see some of the ingenuity there going back in the day too. Some of those old Indians and Harleys and bikes, up at turn of the century, they were like driving a Model T, I could imagine. It's like, well, I only have 2 feet and 2 hands, man. It's like there's 4 levers and 6 pedals and 3. It's like, how do you? I could only imagine riding one
shifters
of those back
and
in the day.
All kinds of stuff.
No doubt. And even this Model A pickup I have in here right now, I drove that thing down around the block and I thought, man, how? I mean,
to drive them. It's not just one hand and you're thinking of this and no, you got to.
No. It commands your complete attention and skill. But not only that, if you think about people in that day, they didn't have the mechanical skills and know-how that many people, at least, maybe of our generation did. It's all automatics now, but it's like, but then on top of that, imagine driving something like that across, you know, across Nevada to California or across the country, you know, you can.
Okay, now think
know,
of this, Aaron. Now think.
I mean, holy
three
cow.
Decades from now, some guys will be talking and they'll go, "Can you imagine driving one of those cars from the 2000s? I mean, they actually had to steer their own car, and they had to.
Steer them.
They had to start it. I mean, you know, now you just. You know, go on your device
teleport.
And it just shows up and you get in it. Can you imagine driving? So,
you just get teleported through your phone.
Yeah, I know. It's just, no, it'll be, can you imagine leaving your house? We don't leave our house, you know?
So. Yeah, really?
But,
imagine
yeah.
actually touching another person?
Yeah, exactly. Having to see other people. So, hey, I'm going to close this show out with the quote of the week from Ken Lingenfelter. Ken Lingenfelter was quoted as saying this week that I truly believe, and I'm paraphrasing, this isn't an exact quote, I truly believe that we are living in the pinnacle of the muscle car era right now.
Hmm.
I think he might be right, because when you look at overall performance and what these cars can do, it's head and shoulders over what they always said was the pinnacle of muscle cars back in the 60s and 70s. And no, the cars today outrun them. I mean, when you can buy a car that you drive to work every single day with 700 horsepower, you know. So
yeah, that's a good point, because I'm always thinking of classic muscle cars. But no, he's right. The contemporary muscle car is quite a ferocious, user-friendly vehicle out there.
I was driving down the freeway to go to my wheel factory yesterday, and guy tooled up alongside me in an all-black, murdered-out Hellcat. And and he's just cruising along, you know. The car was dirty, like he'd been driving it all week, and you know, it was just, that's his daily driver. And I thought, holy crap, man, 700 ponies and all murdered out and trick and just cruising down the freeway. It's just another car, you know. So it makes me think back to when literally, when I was in high school and there were guys with Hemi cars and, you know, crazy stuff now that's worth a fortune. And they were just, you know, hand-me-down cars they were driving, you know. And it'll be that way someday. Can you believe it? You could go to a dealership and buy a Hellcat? So
yeah. Well, I'll tell you, you know, in similar vein but in contrast, motorcycles. You know, I had one of the first 916s in the country. And it was full of, you know, race parts and whatever they had out of production, you know, that they had out of the race bin to make production. And that thing, I remember having to spend a fortune and work, you know, very, very hard with new engineering to try to get that thing to 100 horsepower. I have an Aprilia RSV4 from 2013 that's got 208 horsepower.
Oh, yeah. No, motorcycles are like...
You know, and it's like, how do you ride a bike with 200 horsepower?
I know.
You know,
it's like crazy.
Then again, this Willys, I don't even know what this Willys has from 46 with an F-head. What's it got? Probably 30 horsepower.
Yes.
You know, and it's like,
no, it's crazy, but...
Yeah.
Hey, that's the kind of stuff.
Amazing.
That's the kind of stuff we talk about every week on Shift and Steer.
That's right.
And we want you to follow us on social media. You can follow us at Shift Steer Media on Instagram, on Twitter, and Shift and Steer on Facebook, and of course our website, where you can get downloads, you can get photo galleries, you can find out backgrounds on each of us. We don't have our mugshots there, but that's at shiftandsteer.com. And you know, another week's in the bag. I'm Brad Fanshaw, and you are?
I'm Aaron Hagar.
Had to think about that one, didn't you? And, hey, it's another edition. We're missing Matt the Motorator DeAndrea, but he'll come back with lots of stories from hanging out with Adam, racing
Car
that
Week.
Porsche, and being up at Monterey Car Week. So thanks for listening, everybody.
If you like this show, also listen to Man Seeks Adventure and Dixon's Wild Ride. You can find Man Seeks Adventure at manseeksadventure.com.